everyone, and welcome to episode 2 of the Medieval Podcast. My name is Danielle Sobalski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. And today we're going to be talking about a piece of technology that most of us can't imagine living without, the book. My guest is Dr. Eric Vackel, a professor at the University of British Columbia and a rock star of the book history world. Eric has made a name for himself all over the world, most notably with his work on medieval doodles, appearing on the BBC, CBC, CNN, and even BuzzFeed's list of 8 book historians, curators, specialists, and librarians who are killing it online. I invited Eric to talk with us today about how books were made and used in the Middle Ages, as well as what and why people doodled in their books. This week's episode is sponsored by Arc Humanities Press, who have just published Eric's latest work, Books Before Print. It's a beautiful book that contains over 100 gorgeous color images across over 300 pages, all written in Eric's characteristically engaging style. Arc Humanities specializes in medieval and early modern scholarship in partnership with Amsterdam University Press, and Books Before Print is just one of many great and affordable titles available at their website, arc-humanities.org. Full disclosure, I do some acquisitions work with Arc, although Eric's book is not one of mine. I wish it was. It's always enjoyable to listen to Eric speak about book history, so let's get started. Here's my conversation about medieval books with Dr. Eric Vackel. Hi, Eric, and thanks for joining us on the podcast. I'm really excited to be talking to you about book history today.
Yeah, me too. Thanks for inviting me.
It's a pleasure. Well, you and I met more than a decade ago, and that was the first time actually listening to you that I had really learned about book history, even though I'd taken courses on medieval history and literature before. So I was really happy to get the chance to bring you onto the podcast to tell everybody else about book history. And so the first question I think that we need to address that I didn't know before is what is a book? Because it's not a simple question. No,
this is actually the stuff that we talk about for 2 weeks in class. What's a book and what's it not? Formally, as a book historian, you have to conclude that a book is something that is made out of quires. And those are those packages of stacked leaves that you see when you look at a really expensive book that you buy now in the bookstore. So quires are folded leaves, maybe in the Middle Ages, 5 or 6 together, sometimes 4, and that are bound together to form a book block, and then there's a binding around it. But that's basically a book. So for me as a book historian, what's not a book is something that's not folded, that doesn't contain folded leaves, or something that's flat, like a charter, or a letter. So those are written objects, but not books. So I'm interested in books that actually look very similar to what we have now, squarish, rectangular shape objects that are consisting of leaves that you can leave through and that are basically one entity, a single entity.
Yeah, in your book that's just come out, which is Books Before Print, which we'll tell people about a little bit at the end, you mention a book as being something that is not quite content and it's not quite container. You talk about it being like a glass of milk, right?
Yeah, well, it's the book is the container or the flask or the whatever you put milk in, the glass, I guess. And the text is the contents, the milk. There's often, sometimes people mistake text and book, which is, you know, even today you'll say, oh, I'm reading a book, but you don't mean that you're holding an object in your hand that looks like a book. You mean I'm reading a text, I'm reading a novel or a poetry. So text and book are different things, but we tend to think of them as the same. So when I'm not switched on as a book historian, I also say, hey, I'm reading a book, and it might even be from a computer, a PDF. Mm-hmm. But as a book historian, and I'm sort of going through the door in the classroom and I have students in front of me, then a book is really the object. And I don't care so much what's in it. And in many cases, I don't even read the text because I don't have time. There's so many other things to look at, features, parchment, what does it sound like, what does it smell like, that you don't normally read many things. You read perhaps an ex libris inscription, so an ownership inscription, occasional things in the margin, perhaps the first line of the text to see what it is about. But normally, For me, the book is an object that you don't read as a book historian, whereas the text is a thing that you do read. So that's for me, that's the difference.
Right. And the book, in terms of that rectangular object full of quires that we think of as a quote unquote book now, that was really kind of developed in the Middle Ages, wasn't it?
Yeah, very early in the Middle Ages or late antiquity, there's a transition from roll to codex, as we call it. So codex is that book that consists of folded leaves, so quires. This was in the 4th, 5th centuries. And that was also the transition from papyrus to parchment. And parchment was a better material to make these quires from. You can fold papyrus, so those leaves folded, leaves from plants that are mushed into bifolia. You can fold them, but it doesn't really want to, and it might break. And people tend to write only on one side of them. So it's not an ideal medium material for making long texts. And Christianity had long texts and long discussions about these texts. And so they needed something new, a new book format. And so we tend to connect the emergence of the codex, our modern book form, with the emergence of Christianity. And so that, I would say, is late antiquity or perhaps very early medieval. And so throughout the medieval period, you have predominantly the codex. There are rolls, particularly in the very first centuries, maybe the 5th, 6th centuries, there's still rolls around. And also later in the Middle Ages, and in fact throughout the Middle Ages, there's rolls used in administration. So for accounting, for example, keeping track of your expenses and income, that's easier to do on a roll because you don't have to flip pages, you don't know how many pages you need. So you can basically just add, glue on new sheets and make the roll longer. And at the end of the year, you stop doing that, and then you start a new one for the new year. So rolls are easy and handy for that purpose, but not so much for using as a book. Because imagine if you finished your book and you want to just see what chapter 2 said again about that specific murder that happened. How was that introduced again? And you have to roll quite a bit, meters and meters, which is actually very unhandy and a lot of work. And especially when it's a breakable material, it's not something you want to do. So Codex, the book, was a marvelous invention that actually worked very well for the new time, that is the medieval period.
Right. So when you're talking about what these codices are made out of, you're talking about parchment. And this is another word that's very confusing. When people talk about parchment, what does it mean? Is it the same as parchment paper? So what were people using to write on at the time?
Yeah, parchment paper. It's my biggest frustration when I'm in to get that roll out and see parchment paper. That makes me shiver. It's impossible. It doesn't exist. So parchment is, generally for me, it's everything made out of animal skin.
Right.
So any animal skin turned into a leaf of a bookish object or a book or a flat object like a charter is parchment. Formally, you have to distinguish between the types of animals. And vellum is then calf skin. And other animals can have different names, but it's so confusing. And nobody can really see with a naked eye what animal sort of is at the heart of your book, that it's easier just to say parchment. So in publications, for example, I will say parchment, and I may make a footnote saying, I'm not distinguishing between the various animals. For me, everything non-paper that comes from an animal is parchment.
But that
it was
makes sense.
So that's basically how it was for the Middle Ages up to maybe the 13th century, when books are slowly being turned into bookish objects with the help of paper. And that happens in Italy for the first time. The oldest 13th century paper books we have are Italian. There's some exceptions in France, but Italy seems to be very early. And the rest of Europe follows in the 14th century. So by the mid-14th century, occasionally you have a paper book. But in the centuries before that, even up to a century and a half, paper is used for administration purposes. Okay. So letters, accounts, everything that sort of can be, that doesn't have to look very pretty, that you might even throw away after a year. So as, for example, draft accounts in the administration, after you've done the drafts, you make the nice pretty one, which goes in your archive, of all the expenses and incomes of a certain year, and then you throw the paper draft away. So it was actually very smart to have a cheaper material and something you could easily also recycle.
Right. And early paper was made from linen in Europe, wasn't it? Yeah. But if we go back to parchment for a second, how does a book go from being an animal to being a book? What's the process?
Well, first you have to have animals. So without animals, there's no book. And I sometimes jokingly say, and actually I've written down in various occasions, that what was in a meadow in May could be part of a Bible by the end of the year. And so animal is turned into a meat product mostly, but then you have a byproduct, which is skin. I don't think animals were kept for the skin purposefully just for that. I think it was just for meat and other purposes. But then you have a skin left over, and you can turn it into parchment through a very long process. And a parchment maker will do this. It is very stinky, and it involves lye and baths with moist. But the gist of it is, the end of it is that you'll have a skin that you need to scrape clean while it's sort of framed on a wooden frame, tightened. And you clear the bits of meat flesh off on the one side and the hair on the other, and then you let it dry and stretch. And then when it's done, you sand it, and then you have basically a material that you can turn into books. But it will still very much look like an animal. So the top part has the neck part on it, so it's sticking out a little bit, and the corners are where the legs are, more or less. So you need to do a lot of things after. So you need to cut it into the right shape. You need to decide how large you want your book to be, and then sort of cut out the bifolia from the skin, or fold the entire skin in so many times as needed to get the book of a certain physical format, if you see what I mean, dimensions. And then you can start to write. So then all that work, and then you start from scratch, like at zero. You have nothing yet.
So this is a difficult material to get your hands on and start to write on. So you've seen some pretty damaged manuscripts where there's a hole in it where the parchment maker has done a bad job, and they still kind of muddle through with that, right? So what would people do to get around these holes and mistakes?
Well, scribes tend to ignore the holes, and you can see it very easily when you have holes in a book. Scribes just write around it, and they will ignore sort of any physical parts of the skin that they don't like. They also will sometimes skip parts where the ink doesn't stick very well. And these are patches in the skin that are very fatty, and the ink will not catch. And they know this, or they tend to find out when they write, and they will stop and find the spot where they can continue again. There's a very nice medical manuscript that I looked at not so long ago that skips these fatty parts of the skin. So scribes sort of anticipate, this is what I can do on this spot, so write very well, and this is sort of the limitations of the next stretch, and therefore I will skip this. But it's also very funny. Some scribes put a little line around the holes in the skin as a little fence, so nobody falls in. So it's a fun thing to see scribes struggle with basically animals that are dead.
I never thought of it in just that way. But when they begin to write, they'd have to actually prepare the page so that they were going to write in straight lines, right? So how would they do that?
Well, they have instruments for this, little pricking devices. So it's a stabby object with a pointy thing that you can punch holes in your parchment with, and then you get a ruler essentially and draw lines. If you're early in the Middle Ages, you will get a sharp object and push hard, and then you end up with what's called blind ruling. So it's basically a gutter. There's no actual line on the parchment. If you're later in the Middle Ages, say after 1150, it will basically be a sort of a pencil lead, so a little stick of lead. You'll pull between these two prickings in the left and right margin, and these prickings were not removed. Sometimes they're put very much in the outer margin, as far as possible to the edge of the paper or parchment. And then you can cut it away, and you wonder if people who planned to make a really fancy, beautiful book did that. But I don't think anybody's ever looked at it, what the distance is between the edge of the paper and the stabbing. it makes sense. And in Carolingian times, the holes are very close to the text. So there was no consideration of potentially cutting it away later. Right. So this is sort of what you do next. So you prepare the parchment or later paper for writing on, and you need to have some guidance because you can't write straight. Only when you have paper, you can see in the structure of the paper sort of a horizontal movement. And so with paper manuscripts, scribes would sometimes skip this laborious process and go straight to writing. So fold the paper, form quires, and start writing immediately, where they use the structure of the paper as a guidance. But normally you'll see prickings and some sort of ruling. And this is actually also where the design of the book and of the page is born, because at that point, in the very early stages, you have to decide what we call mise en page, so what your page design will look like. So it's not in the writing that this happens, but it's in the preparation for the writing that you actually show to yourself, the scribe, what you will do later when you start writing.
Right. And you'd have to make a plan before you started writing for where you would have an illustration, illumination, or maybe something helpful to tell people where to look next or something
that. Precisely. But also even the certain texts and genres came with certain conventions as far as design is concerned. So if you're at a university and you have a law text, you probably want to also have a commentary around it, which means you have to cram two texts on one page. And then you may also want to have some room for your own notes, which means there needs to be room for a third dimension. And all that needs to be anticipated. We sometimes forget that if you look at a really complicated manuscript with like a law text in the middle and a textus inclusus type glossing around it, which is square bracket glossing, which is a commentary draped around the text, sort of embracing the text, and then student notes around it, all that was already anticipated right after the parchment was prepared. So sometimes months earlier, if it takes half a year to write a book, you will have prepared this and had this idea of what the design will look like half a year earlier, which is quite remarkable.
Yeah, I do want to get into how readers interacted with books, but I just want to finish the mechanics first so that we can get into more of the discussion of how readers used books. So if we've written our book out, we've illuminated it, which would be kind of the last step after the writing, just in case the writing doesn't go well. Oh, before I get any further, if you made a mistake writing on this parchment, what would you do? Is the whole sheet gone? Or
no, well, you can ignore it. There are many mistakes uncorrected in text, so you would almost like to think that scribes also ignored that stage of correcting. We tend to think of scribes as very careful and meticulous, but you know, if you're hasty or if you think that your reader might not notice or might not mind, then you can just leave it as is. If you do have a mistake that you want correcting, there's various things you can do. You can scrape it off almost immediately after the ink is dry. So you keep on writing and then you go back what you did earlier in the day and correct your pages. And you can basically, with a penknife, just sort of pinch it off. It comes off quite easily. And then you can, with sandpaper, remove any residue. And then you basically have a hole in your text that you can fill again. Okay. This is when you have this. This is called writing on erasure. It's actually very easy to spot because the parchment has had an extra little rub at one particular location, and you usually notice that very, very clearly. It feels a little bit rougher. So if you think that you have one of those spots, you carefully look if the people in the library are not watching you, and then you feel with your fingers if it feels a little bit rougher. And that's interesting because it means that something else was there before. And then you can ask yourself, so what was there and why was it removed? Was it simply a skip of the eye? Was it a word that he misread? Or is it perhaps even a redaction? Was something afterwards sort of systematically cleaned up or changed throughout the codex. And that happens as well. And those are the very interesting things, because it allows you to see over the shoulder of not just the scribe, but also the scribe editor. So yeah. Somebody who's not just writing a text, but also like a physical text, material text, but is also involved in the intellectual text. He or she is trying to make it better, improve it. And then those spots where something else was written before that was scraped away become very important. And so you can take your blue light and, like a Sherlock Holmes, try to read the reading from underneath it, right? It's not always possible. Sometimes it is.
Yeah,
that's very exciting stuff.
Exactly. It does feel like detective work. And I think, you know, some scribes might be kind of appalled that we can do that now, but we do check out to see what's underneath. So if we've completed our text, we've done our illustration, all that's done, how is it bound together, all of our quires?
Well, you bring it to the binder. So all these stages are separated. So there's a person usually preparing the parchment, so making, turning an animal into parchment. There's another person preparing the quires for writing and then filling it. There's another person usually for all the chapter headings in red. And then there's another person for illustrating, but also for binding. So you bring it to a binder, and he will basically put all the quires in a lineup and stab through the heart of them, so that you can actually put a cord through and bind them on leather thongs that you can then sort of bang into the wooden boards. So they drill holes in the wooden boards, the leather thongs go through, and on those thongs all the quires are dangling, and then you pull the thongs through the holes in the boards, in the wooden boards, until they go no further. Then you put a peg in, and if you do that in four locations, which is usually the four or maybe six even locations if it's a large book, you end up with an entity that is not even glued together. It's all pegged together. It's all dry, but it sits for 1,000 years or even longer. It's quite remarkable to have a medieval book in your hands in an original binding that might have been bound for 1,000 years, and it still works the same way and as crisp as it was the first day it was created. And so that was true, remarkable technology with an enormous longevity, more so than our current iPads and whatever technologies, right? Our phones die after 3 or 4 years because the phone companies or Apple wants us to buy a new one every 2 years. But these medieval manuscripts are still there after 1,000 years and function in exactly the same way as they were supposed to on day one.
Yeah, that, I don't get me started on that, because that is something that I really love about these manuscripts, is that they can be used in exactly the same way as they were 1,000 years ago, which I think is phenomenal. So when you got it bound, you could get it bound really simply, right? Or you could get it bound in a very fancy way. Is that right?
Yeah, I think many books also were left unbound. We don't tend to see that so much because they are bound later in the 15th century. So you have these wonderful 15th century composite manuscripts, as we call them, which consist of 3, 4, 5, 10, 20 parts, smaller parts, all bound together. And you tend to look at them as one book. They are one entity now, and they were made so in the 15th century. But before that, they were almost like single quires that you could take to class. There's no need to put a binding around it. So that's the sort of the lowest end of the spectrum, no binding at all. And it was far more popular than we imagine now, but we have very few cases left. The next step would be to have what we call a limp binding, which is basically a piece of parchment or even leather, something rough, unfinished, wrapped around the quires. And each quire is run through the parchment with a string, usually also a piece of parchment that you can sort of string together like you would with one of those white tie-on clips, in exactly the same way. And they're also still in place after 500 years. I mean, imagine that you put a tie on a garbage bag and it's 500 years still there. I don't think that will happen, but with these books, it's still in place. So we have then thin books with maybe 2, 3, 4 quires, short text, that you can take with you because you can fold it a little bit. You can roll it almost. There's no wooden boards inside. And so it's a cheap way of doing it, but also a very convenient way of doing it, portable way of doing it. And that was a genre of bookbindings that was very popular with students. So if you take a bunch of these, and there's some really interesting studies on them done, a few years ago, and you look at the text inside, it's all university texts. So that makes sense. We don't want to spend too much money on the appearance of the book. I only need the text. It's the most important thing for me. So it's exactly the other way around as the modern book historian. So, and then at the far end of the spectrum, you have the pretty bindings with maybe even gems attached to them. But those are very rare. So I think the most common original medieval book binding, it sits somewhere between sort of the middle of the road, that is those limp bindings, and the fancy bindings with gems. And they're basically just simple leather, brown or whitish, with two wooden boards protecting the book and protecting the parchment from buckling, with two clasps to close them, and maybe a fenestra that is a title shield on the front so the reader knows what's inside without opening it. So that's sort of the basic monastic binding, I think.
Right. So when you talk about monastic binding, let's just talk for a second. Who was doing most of the writing and book creation at this time? Was it the monasteries? Was it private companies?
Well, I think we all learned in school that monks wrote books in the Middle Ages. There's lots of 19th and 20th century illustration materials from the school environment to support this. But I think if you look at the medieval period itself, the evidence suggested up to 1200 monks were probably involved mostly in book production. And I think 9 out of 10 books produced before 1200 were produced by a monk in a monastery or a nun in a nunnery, sort of a member of a religious house. After 1200, the trade of making books, sort of writing, but also some of the other trades connected to it, like illustration and binding, moves to the cities. And this is often explained by the emergence of the universities, that there's so much of a demand for books in the cities, more so than before, and around 1,200 universities in Europe start to come up, that people in the city, commercial individuals, start to make these objects, books, for money, for an income, and that sort of becomes the norm. So that by the 15th century, documentary evidence also suggests that monks themselves bought books from these individuals. So yes, monks wrote books in the Middle Ages, but up to 1200. And after that, they also did, but increasingly less so. And I think if you take a random book and you don't know where it was made in the 14th century, there's a good chance this is a commercial individual, even when the contents are theological or religious devotional. So that doesn't matter. So they copied anything.
Right. So let's get back to the contents for a second, because we talked a little bit about how students would use these books and how sometimes you would have an initial text right in the middle and you'd have commentary outside. So can you talk a little bit about how these were used, how different texts were used in the book in sort of a dialogue, maybe?
Well, the text is always a dialogue with a reader because there's a person reading it. And since texts were so expensive to produce in the form of a medieval manuscript, one can assume that any text that survives, any book that we have now in our libraries, was part of that dialogue situation where they beam out a message to a reader and a reader receives it and will have thought something. So that's the silent second part of the dialogue. A reader just thinks something. But then many readers also had an active part in which they grabbed their pen and added something to the text or to the margin. And this actually happens very frequently, so much so that you would have to think that readers were actually reading with a pen and ink nearby, which is not something that you tend to, you think of a reader as sitting in a chair with a cat on his lap. But in the Middle Ages, you needed to have some tools nearby at any time because you don't know when you needed to say something back to the text. And so this dialogue, this active second part of the dialogue where the reader responds to the text in writing is most often seen in the university environment where text was systematically commented upon and you were also induced and encouraged to do so by your teachers. So university education was all about dialogue. It's all about hearing your teacher say something or reading something in a university text and then trying to formulate an answer to it or a response or disagreement. And often these counter voices would be put in the margin, or what was also put in the margin were quotes from other people that would help you formulate your dissent or formulate a sort of more meaningful depth behind the text. Sort of Augustine says something very complicated, but here we have Aquinas who has something sensible to say on the same topic. Let's put this little quote in the margin. And so it happens throughout the Middle Ages. I mean, there's a lot of research done on marginal things happening in the margin in the early Middle Ages. But in the later Middle Ages, especially the university, you see that this becomes a very norm of interacting with books, so not just reading it, but also doing something back to the text. And then when this happens, you also want to have instruments, means, to do this more efficiently. And so, for example, what was done was to extend the marginal space so as to accommodate counter voices and additional comments. But also, then, if you have a lot of marginal space because you anticipate that you will have to say a lot back to the text, and just to give you an indication, in some cases of university texts that I've seen, 75% of the page is left blank. So only 25% is filled, and the rest is for the reader. So the student, if that happens, you also want to have a little bit of help because there's a lot of vast white space where you can put your writing. So then they start to divide the white space into sort of comment boxes, as I call them, so cubes, squares. And squares are used for certain types of commentary. So there's usually three or four columns of white space, but they're actually made into columns, so vertical columns. But then it's not so that everybody who starts to comment on a page will start at the left top of this white marginal space. They do it somewhere near the line where the text that they find interesting or disagree with is placed. But then you still have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different columns to do this in, and they don't do it at the same location. So it almost seems, this is something I'm working on at the moment, to make sense of adding a voice to the page and doing it in a certain location on a page that has a lot of white. So why is it sometimes in the left top corner and other times in the right top corner? Is it meaningful? Is the location where you put something meaningful? And if that is so, is that meaningful throughout Europe in the same way? Or is it something that you can tie to one environment, Paris University? Because there's instruction books that tell students what to do and how to write comments. So is it also that we must think of sort of instructions to the students, you are here in Paris, and therefore personal opinions are put in the left of the three columns, whereas reactions to the teacher are put in the right one of the three columns. And the middle one you keep and blank until you need space for either one of these two other ones. I don't know if that's the case, but so this is one of the things that you can still study when you look at marginal space. So it's not just blank space, boring. It's actually the start of really interesting kind of research.
Right. I guess you're going to have to actually read the comments to figure this out.
Yeah. But you know what? Those are very hard to read because they're very personal hands and they're often in sort of some sort of semi-cursive. And it takes and very high on abbreviations because these were meant for yourself. They're not meant for me. And so it's a very personal way of writing it down. So I try to avoid reading them because then my day would be filled with reading 5 comments. And I'd rather have my day filled with writing 5 pages of general observations. But sometimes, yes, you have to.
So when we think about people reading right now, I mean, there's a lot of people that will not read a paperback with a pen in hand. And we know that medieval people did read with a pen in hand for these commentaries and stuff. But you've also become kind of a world superstar talking about medieval doodles. So you've found that people will read with a pen in their hand and they'll start to draw in the manuscript. Yeah. So what kind of things do they draw?
Well, anything that we would draw. If I were to ask you, what do you normally draw when you have a boring meeting? Then you would say, I don't know what you would say, maybe lines and squares, but you might also draw some real life things that you don't even realize. So I think doodles, well, let me be clear. Doodles are not made usually because people were bored. So it's easy to think this, to make this parallel with our modern times. There was a necessity to make doodles. That is, there was a necessity to test the pen. So when you write, after a few pages, you have to cut the nib again. because it's made out of a feather or a reed, and it will wear off. So you need a fresh point tip. And to do this, you cut it, but then you need to know if it works well, right? The previous one worked well. Is this one that I cut of equal width, for example, as the one I just had? Because otherwise, you can see in the book as you read, oh, that's like a variation of width nip width, and it looks very nasty. So they found an empty piece of space, usually a separate sheet of parchment that was cast away, and they would test their pen in a variety of ways. Lines, dots, musical notation was very popular because it allowed you to push on the nib. And then you have squares that appear. If you push shortly on the nib and go down, there's basically a square, and that's musical notation. So you see musical notations, I think, for that reason, very often on these test sheets. But also words, including the words "I'm testing my pen," and that's, which is very, very, very funny. And also beautiful little doodles, so drawings that sort of, yeah, can have any shape you want. They have beautiful initials with people inside. I have one tattooed on my leg from a 13th century Leiden manuscript. Few people know this, but now I guess more people do. So they're actually little mini pieces of art. But you always have to remember that this was not done deliberately necessarily. I mean, yes, deliberately, because their brain told them to make a face of a monk, but it was done because they needed to test their pen, and therefore they moved on afterwards and went back to their original activity, which was copying a text.
So
There's something, can I say one more thing about this?
of
This
course.
yeah, I always thought, and I think we may all have done, even though we didn't know, that they would turn to blank leaves in the back of a manuscript, because that's where you see them now. They're often in the back on a blank leaf. But then recently I found doodles on unbound bifolia. So I think what happened is that they used an unbound bifolium until it was full, or discarded piece of folium that was until it was full or time to turn it into fly leaves. And then it ended up on the binder's desk and was turned into a fly leaf. And that's why they're in the back now. I'm convinced that that's what's happening, which is really interesting, because it means that all those hands and drawings on it are from the same environment as where the book is bound. So if it's monastic, you can now say these doodles are from local inhabitants of this monastery, and you couldn't before. So I find so that even there's a very interesting new dimension to explore. So, medieval manuscripts, you're never done with them.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I hadn't thought about that, about using them as fly leaves once you're done testing your pen.
Yeah, this is why they're sometimes upside down as well. So you have pen trials upside down. That makes no sense if you in a book, right? Then presumably you would get the book out and open it normally. So that this from it just shoves around the desk of the scribe, and it's slowly filled with doodles, and then it ends up in another book.
Right. Yeah, when you talk about creating a book, it's often these choirs that are filled with different things that are, stories or maybe prayers, and they're all put together. I remember you saying one time, I could be wrong about this, but I remember you saying one time that sometimes you could go to a store and you could get choirs that were already made and then bind them together to make your own book. Is that right? Have I got that right?
Yeah, there's various ways of doing this. There's a good article on this by Peter Gumbert, who shows that there were pre-made choirs that you could buy, presumably also in various sizes. Because with paper, pre-made choirs with paper will all have the same dimensions if you fold it once, twice, or three times, because the standard size of paper, those folded twice, will be the same throughout, right? So you can buy a whole stack. But if you have parchment skins, that's a little bit more difficult to get those of the same size. I mean, you can get a very large skin, fold it two times, and then cut it to the size that you want it to. But then you lose a lot of good parchment. And so I wonder how that worked. Did you go to the store and ask for parchment of certain dimensions, and then you would get 16 quires? So would the parchment maker already pre-select 16 skins of more or less the same size, so that he could deliver 16 quires that were the same size for one book, because you need between 15 and 20 quires for a regular text? Or is it something that you would just have to scrape together as a scribe? Okay, this parchment maker at this moment will give me 4. Now I go to the other town and get another 4 of the same size. Now I can get my large book together of 40 centimeters in height, which is unusual. And it requires skins that are quite big, and larger skins are more unusual than smaller ones.
Yeah.
So I don't know how that works. But basically, yes, you could buy them prefab, or you could do everything yourself, including butchering the animal. So Cistercian houses in the middle of nowhere had animals walk around for food, and then monks or lay monks or their servants would sort of cut these animals up for supper, and then presumably somebody in the house would turn that into parchment, the remaining skin.
Yeah, so this is why, you know, when you ask what a book is, or you start talking about books, it becomes a long conversation, because there are so many different pieces to it. And then one last thing I wanted to mention that I thought was interesting when I came across it, I think this is something that you mentioned back in the day as well, was that people had a used book trade, which we don't tend to think about. You know, you think about having this luxury manuscript and keeping it forever, even if you doodle in it. But they did have a used book trade as well.
Yes. Yeah. Well, every surviving medieval manuscript is secondhand.
That's right.
and most of them 20 times over. Mm-hmm. If you think in generations who own this, right? 20 is not too weird to think. But there was also a lively trade in secondhand books in university cities. For example, we have evidence for this of how much it's sold for. There's a nice case in a Cambridge manuscript where in the 14th century, a book from the 9th century is sold. So apparently in a different script. So it still sells, even though it's Carolingian minuscule and it's not being read for a long time in the 14th century. People still buy manuscripts written in that particular unusual old-fashioned type of script. It's like for us buying a book from 19th century Germany with that Gothic letter, right? And then voluntarily start to read that, which is not all that pleasant. But people did it. And the other thing is that you see prices mentioned in books. So at the top of a fly leaf, you sometimes see 3 shilling or something like that, 3S or 8S for expensive books. And that means it was sold secondhand. It's very hard to date these. Most of them that I've seen are 15th century. There might be some older ones, but those are indications that they were apparently then in a bookstore on a pile, you know, sale of the week, eight shilling. Get your fix. And that's really nice to think about, because it's then you're talking about the second reader or the third or fourth reader, and they inherited the preferences of the first reader, who had the book made. So other than print today, you have a choice as a first reader in the Middle Ages how you want to have your book prepared. And we talked about this in book design. But as a second reader, you basically have to follow what the first reader did or wanted. So I think this is also why you see secondhand books sold in university cities will likely have text presented in the university format. And then it's easier to buy and to use than if you have a text that is presented in a very different format for a very different occasion and setting, and you have to somehow convert it into using it as a university object. I think that's less frequent.
Yeah. Well, it's just something that I don't know, I hadn't thought of before speaking to you about it, listening to you talk about it. And I just think that's an interesting aspect of the book trade that we don't tend to think of initially. Now, if people want to read your book, your newest book is Books Before Print, which has just come out from Arc Humanities Press, right?
Yeah, it's, it came out in late October, early November.
Yeah, and it's already sold super well, so that's great. Congratulations.
Yeah, the first paperback sold out in 2 weeks.
Yes.
Some pre-orders, I think. I have no idea how it goes at the moment, but I think it might go well. It's nice to see that it's being used. I sort of have more interest in I have a bigger interest in how this one goes than my other books. Well, as a scholar, it's very odd. You produce articles and books and you shoot them out into the world. And then maybe in a few years, you see it appear in footnotes.
Right.
You like to think that on day two of publication, people will start to read it and use it in class and in their research immediately. I don't think that's the case. It ends up in a library, and then it takes months to end up on a shelf. And then some people might see it. And ultimately, when people start to quote it, more people usually start to use it. But with this Arc Humanities Press book, the Books Before Print, I wanted to have a book that people actually enjoyed. I don't think in terms of enjoyment with my sort of solid scholarly publications. But here it was very invested in this, that to make a nice book with great images. There's 120 color pictures, and most of them I took myself. So I want people to read this and have fun with it. Which is why I was very happy to hear that it's doing so well.
Yes, I've looked at the book myself, and it's a great book. It's not a book that is aimed at people who have been doing this stuff for years, but for people who are just coming to learn about book history. And it's such a friendly book to read. It's fantastic. So congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Yeah,
for people who want to get into your book, your work before reading this book, they can go to your Tumblr blog, right? Which you've had for a few years, which
I think
is...
The Tumblr is, it's sort of there, but it's not actively used anymore. That's another story why that is. It's basically because the longer you write your posts, the fewer people are interested. But that's Tumblr. They want images and a short caption. And I do that in Twitter.
Okay.
So I thought I'd not do the Tumblr anymore. But Medieval Books is still active as a blog. So
right.
medievalbooks.nl. And in fact, part of Books Before Print, the publication we just talked about, is from that blog. I basically reworked the posts and added things to it and changed the language a bit.
Right. I'm going to give people your Twitter handle at the end, and we'll put it in the show notes as well, because you have amazing pictures, not just of manuscripts, but of reading aids like book carousels, bookmarks, and even little imprints of glasses and cat paw prints.
Yeah.
So it's definitely worth following. So thanks so much, Eric, for talking to me about book history.
Welcome.
It's
thanks
been such
for
a pleasure.
Having me on your show.
It's our pleasure. Thank you so much.
Goodbye.
As Eric mentioned, if you'd like to read more of his work and see some of his amazing pictures for yourself, you can check out his blog at medievalbooks.nl, or you can follow him on Twitter at Eric, E-R-I-K, _ Kvakkel, Kwakkel. His new book is Books Before Print, available through Arc Humanities Press at arc-humanities.org. Before we go, we're going to check in with Peter from medievalist.net to find out what's going on the website this week. What's going on, Peter?
Hi, Daniel. How are things?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I've been under the weather for the last couple of days, but the site has still been getting some content up, and I want to tell you first about a piece by Ken Monshine on his medievalism column, and he takes a look at Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris and how much of it was that we see there is a 19th century restoration. It's very interesting to see how they had their own ideas about what the Middle Ages looked like, and it's a really fascinating piece by Ken. You can also find a post that we did about books on the Middle Ages that are now in the public domain. On January 1st, tens of thousands of works that were published in 1923 had their copyright come to an end. So what we did is we went out and looked for books that would be of interest to a medievalist. So you can come and check our site. We've got 13 books there that are kind of interesting reads. So finally, we got some Icelandic magic on the site. We take a look at the Galdrabrok, a 16th century Icelandic manuscript that has all these magic spells. So we give a few of our favorites. So if you're looking to cause trouble or protect yourself from all sorts of bad things, this is something to check out. So that's what's on the site this week. And we've got some more things coming up. We have some more columns that'll be starting in the next couple of weeks. So we're really excited about that.
That's great. Thanks so much. I hope you feel better soon.
Oh, thanks.
Talk to you next week. You can subscribe to the Medieval Podcast on iTunes or wherever you like listening. And you can follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can follow me, Danielle Sabolsky, on social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5-Minute Medievalist. And you can find my books, The 5-Minute Medievalist and The 5-Minute Medievalist's Guide to Surviving the Zombie Apocalypse, on Amazon. Our music today is Beyond the Warriors by Gee Frog. Thanks everyone for listening, and have a great day.